Hi, this is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
I think we start with a story. I have three kids, and the second of which was a very irritable child when he was little. He's now a fair bit older than that. And I had this great sort of seamless transition of a story into some slides. And about a week and a half ago, I thought I'd better have a look at the timing of this presentation and how long I had to speak. And I realised that I was actually speaking on nutrition, not infant irritability. So we don't have a story to start with. I do not like green eggs and ham, which is about nutrition in infants. And I guess to me, what I would speak about would be determined by my colleagues in emergency. I'm a general paediatrician. I don't work in emergencies. I go down to emergency when I need to, but I don't work there. And this topic is for emergency physicians or trainees. So I thought I'd walk down to emergency and try and find a few ideas of how we go about this talk. My emergency is nothing like Michelle's emergency that she described, at least not the bits I look at. And my colleagues gave me a few suggestions. Once they said that's a terrible topic for a talk, and then they suggested I change it to bronchiolitis, or in fact do infant irritability, which I'm sure Katie wouldn't appreciate. They did actually give me a few reasonable threads. And I think the biggest thread is, what is normal? So for an emergency room or an emergency physician or an emergency trainee, we want to know, what about a baby's presentation with respect to their nutrition sits within the normal range? And I do dozens and dozens of six-week checks on babies. So they range from your extreme prems, 23, 4-weekers, coming in after discharge, very vulnerable families, disastrous social setups, to the completely healthy, well-term, normal vaginal delivery, everything's fine, very empowered parents with plenty of money, very health literate, and of course the most worried. And they come in with all manner of problems, and they've usually seen someone before they see me. They've seen their maternal or child health nurse, they've probably seen their GP, they might have been to their chiropractor, they might have been to a tarot card reader. I'm sure they've got friends with babies. They might have even talked to their local fishmonger. So they've had lots and lots of information given to them. So what am I going to add? Yes, I'm a pediatric and neonatal specialist, but they've got a lot of information running around in that soup that they've been given. So I think that my job is actually to point out the normal, not the abnormal, not talk them through a whole lot of problems. It's actually to demonstrate that the majority of their problems are actually normal. Doesn't mean they're not problems, but they're still normal. But as emergency people, I guess we need to go a bit further than just normal, because we're trying to work out where we're varying from the normal. So I've got three main questions that I guess I'm posing today that I'd like to try and answer for you to help you when you get these babies in your emergency departments. The first is, when to reassure. So there's lots of normal here, and we'll go through what it is. When can we be happy to say to mum or dad or whoever's brought the baby in that this is actually within the realms of normal, and although you're worried, you don't have to be too worried, and that you can probably head home without us doing too much? What are your red flags, i.e. all the things you don't want to miss, the serious disease? Sorry, my ears are a bit small for this. Pity it's not plugged into my nose. Where are the problems that we really don't want to send a sick kid home with? And then, when do we refer? So when do we send the families home, or when do we call our specialist colleagues, refer them to an outpatient, etc.? The theme of this conference is science and story, I believe. So that's where I guess this talk comes in. Where is the art versus where is the science? And I think a lot of medicine is about that. But we're doctors, right? We're trained in evidence. We practice, or I hope we practice, evidence-based medicine. We use algorithms. We have various diagnostic skills in our head and at our hands. So we should be able to explain all the variations in every baby that comes in and does something that the parent thinks is abnormal, right? I beg to disagree. And to use this, let's use Gemma. So Gemma is 6 weeks old. She may or may not be related to me. And her name may or may not even be Gemma. And in fact, she may or may not even be 6 weeks old in that picture. But anyway, let's forget about the details. So Gemma's presented to the emergency department with a constellation of symptoms and a very strung out, stressed mother. Dad might be there, but Mum's brought her in and she wants some answers. This baby is feeding poorly. Breastfed, takes 40 minutes, sometimes 50 to get through a feed. Baby's on and off the breast, often falling asleep, needs to be woken a fair bit, cold face or usher on the face, changing the nappy, trying to do things to prompt the baby to feed. Lots of rashes. This baby does rashes really well. Spots all over the face, little pimples, crusting all through the scalp, can't get rid of that. Nappy rash everywhere, we've tried everything, can't get rid of it. You know, we've tried bath oil, we've tried pawpaw cream, we've tried QV oil, we've tried everything, Doc, and it's not going away. This baby isn't growing well. How do I know? Because the maternal and child health nurse has told me on multiple occasions. We're seeing her each week. We're tracking the weight, sometimes twice a week, and she just isn't pleased with our day-to-day or week-to-week or half-week-to-half-week variations in our weight. And we're vomiting. We do vomiting well. Every feed, we vomit. We bring up some milk, mostly only milk. Looks like the whole feed to me. And, you know, even between feeds, she vomits clear, might have a few white chunks in it, and she's unhappy. She's back-arching. She's back-swallowing. She's an angry little girl, and then when we put her down, she gets angry at us, so we have to pick her up. Sorry, I reverted to we, haven't I? We have to pick her up, and then it starts the whole process again. So we've got a lot of questions. So when I'm presented with that information, I ask myself, where's the normal? What information have I been given in that very long history from a very stressed parent about what is normal? The answer is all of it. Every single symptom I have just read out to you is a physiological variant of normal that does not suggest pathology in any way, shape or form. That's not nice to hear as the parent because you've brought your kid in for an answer or a test or whatever reason that you have behind your presentation, but the reality is it's normal and our job is to explain to the family that that's the case. So when can we reassure? And I guess a quick trip through those symptoms will allow us to do that. So babies feed poorly a lot of the time. Breastfeeding's hard. I'm sure there are plenty of mothers in this audience who have breastfed or are breastfeeding. And it doesn't always go to plan. Babies don't read the books. They do what they want to, and it doesn't always work well. So it often takes a while. Sure, some babies feed in 10 minutes, but plenty of babies, especially at the start, take up to an hour to breastfeed. They might get quicker over time, but they still take a long time. And they often need to be woken. You know, if you go into any hospital that has neonatal services, you'll see the midwives there teaching the mums how to breastfeed by putting cold face washes on the kid's face and getting them off the breast and changing the nappy to try and wake them up a bit. You've got to push them to feed, so that's not abnormal. Rashes are common. I'm sure as emergency colleagues, and I know you're not all emergency in this room, you see oodles of rashes in emergency and you've got to try and work out which is the bad one, which isn't. Babies at 6 to 8 weeks are covered in rashes. They have milia, they have baby acne, they have seborrheic dermatitis, they have nappy rash. I'm not saying none of them need no management, but they're not worrying pathology. Sorry. Go backwards. Slow growth. I think slow growth is an interpreted thing. So a lot of families come to me in my rooms telling me their baby is not growing well. They haven't plotted the baby on a graph. They haven't looked at it over or using data. They've taken the impression of one person, probably at one time point, who's taken a measurement from the week before and the next week and said, your growth's not good. So they presume their baby's not thriving. I think it's really important to look at growth longitudinally. I often get the book of the mums, the baby's book. In Victoria, we have a green book. I'm not sure what the other states have, what colour. And I plot about three numbers, and the parents all look at me like, why are you not doing all the different numbers? Because I only want three. I just want to know, over time, whether longitudinal growth is satisfactory. And vomiting, so over 85% of babies vomit, yeah? Always. They vomit all the time. I had my first two babies vomited up to 12, maybe 18 times a day at 10 months of age. They were fine. You know, we had to scrub the pumpkin off the floor, but there was nothing wrong with them. As long as you're growing okay, there's not severe irritability with the vomiting, and you're vomiting up mostly milk, it's fine. It's just vomiting. And then a bit of evidence if you need to back up normal to families, and I think this is important, not just to back it up for families, but actually to back it up for doctors. There's some good evidence that's come out of Melbourne's Royal Children's Hospital, where they did some studies using pH probes. This is not new evidence. This is, you know, 10, 15 years old now. And that correlated the symptoms of neonatal distress in babies that had a clinical diagnosis of gastroesophageal reflux, and it correlated it with whether there was reduced acidity, or reduced pH, I should say, increased acidity, on the pH probe in the esophagus at the time. And the bottom line was, if you don't vomit physically, i.e. not just back swallow, vomit, at least four times a day, there is no correlation between irritability and the process of reflux up the esophagus, which I guess brings into question our sort of time-honoured assumption of silent reflux. I personally question its existence, but anyway, I didn't say that to any mothers in the room. PPIs are no better than placebo. Now, this is very well articulated in a couple of very large RCTs that have been done in the last 5 to 10 years, and you know, this is something that until, well, my practice, 10 years ago, I was prescribing PPIs to babies at least 5 times a week. Now I'd prescribe them 5 times a year because they are not better than placebo. Doesn't mean they don't help the occasional patient, but on a, I guess, a global or a large scale, they don't help. And this is the hardest one, I think, for people to reassure families with, and that is that physiological irritability is physiological. It's normal. It's what we used to call colic, right? Babies get angry or are unsettled or are harder to deal with at around that 6 to 8 week peak, and there is no evidence to say that we can help it. And when I say we, I don't mean doctors. I mean doctors, osteopaths, chiros, maternal and child health nurses, fishmongers, tarot card readers. It doesn't matter. There is no evidence to say we can change this phenomenon in blinded trials. So there's been plenty of small trials in varying disciplines, medicine included, where they've looked at small numbers of babies and proven a difference. But A, they either haven't had a placebo, or B, they haven't blinded the parent to the placebo. And there's some really good studies, and I won't tell you what discipline, where they did a very, very large trial in the UK, and they looked at a treatment given to a baby at 6 weeks for irritability, and they proved that it worked. And then they did another trial exactly the same. The only difference was they blinded the families. It didn't work. All of a sudden, when the family didn't know what they were getting. So nothing works is the bad news. Here's the best evidence. It's not a study. It's a collection of tens of thousands of children over 6 different countries on multiple continents that graphs normal. And you can, you know, agree or disagree as to whether CDC or WHO have the better data. WHO are slightly more global in their approach to where they get their stats from. But the reality is, that's normal. And unless you're not doing what that graph says you should do, your baby is normal. So I have countless numbers of families coming in with their kid who's not growing, according to whoever's told them that. You plot them out, they're fine. There's nothing wrong with them. They might be small, but they're growing consistently. And I know all of this reassurance is nice for you as emergency workers. However, you want to know where the bad stuff is. You want to predict where the red flags are and use that to help you in your practice moving forward so that you don't send a kid home with a disastrous pathology that turns up a day later in a bad place. So I've just got a few, I guess, snippets that I would add with each of those core symptoms that this little baby Gemma has come in with to help guide us as to varying pathology. I'm sure the first no one in this room is going to very rapidly miss, and that is if your poor feeding and poor growing baby is lethargic or febrile, you need to escalate. They don't go home. And lethargy doesn't mean it takes me half an hour or an hour to feed. Lethargy means the examination of the infant, or what mum tells you the infant is like compared to normal, is acutely different. A baby losing weight, that's a bit different to not growing. So babies can grow slowly or grow, you know, underneath the third centile consistently, but if they're actually losing weight, that would be a bit of a concern to me for more, I guess, acute or sinister pathology. Dropping centiles, so I've put an asterisk on that, and that's because, remember, we have a definition of failure to thrive in medicine, and I'm sure you are all aware of it, that you have to cross two centiles. I haven't yet called the WHO, but they only have two centile lines each side of the 50, which is a little bit trickier, whereas CDC had three or four. So dropping two centiles is a bit harder if you're using the WHO chart. But if you are dropping multiple centiles, that's not good either if you're growing. And then irritability during feeds I've added in there, primarily because that talks to true gut pathology. So a baby that's angry while they're feeding, usually feeding comforts babies. Babies that get angry as they feed, I'd be worried about things like cow's milk protein enteropathy or even a severe reflux. Kids who vomit, so again, your emergency doctors, I'm not going to tell you what you're looking at here, projectile with every feed. Well, I will tell you, it's pyloric stenosis, if it's progressive projectile vomiting, and obviously bilious vomiting speaks to abdominal obstruction, so don't send those kids home, please. Again, if you're vomiting and you're losing weight, then your vomiting's not good. You really shouldn't be losing weight. And finally, again, the blood and mucus in the stool sends us a message about cow's milk protein intolerance, or at least an enteropathy of some description. And then rashes, I've only put one thing in here because, look, the vast majority of rashes in six-week-olds are not irrelevant, but they're not serious. So we can be very reassuring and maybe give a few simple strategies that I'm not going to go through today. The one I've put up here, and I'm sure you're not going to send your kid home with widespread petechiae or anything, so I haven't even mentioned that, but the one I've put in here I think is important, and that's eczema under 3 months. So eczema is an atopic condition, yes? And generally speaking, in older people, it's caused by environmental allergens. And the speaker to my right is an expert in all of that stuff. So I guess the one I want to point out is that eczema in under 3 months is generally a food protein-related allergen. So if they come in with widespread eczema at that age, unless they've got zinc deficiency, it's likely that you're dealing with a food protein-induced problem, and the most commonly induced food protein at that age is clearly cow's milk, whether that's through mum's breast milk or as a formula. So moving on from our history, now we probably need to do some tests, right? I get plenty of calls from very diligent and well-spoken and cohesive registrars and residents and others from mixed emergencies. I work in a mixed emergency, not a PED. And they give me a lovely history that recounts everything we've just talked about. And then they go on and tell me that the kid's got a normal FBE, a normal CRP, a normal UAC, and their dipstick of their urine is clear. If they're really excited, they then go on and tell me they've got a normal venous gas. And if they're really, really enthusiastic, they then tell me they've given a 10 mil per kilo normal saline because the baby looked a little bit dry. There is no standard tests in babies, or in children, in fact. So you need to give me a very, very good reason why you've done any test in the first place for any child. Which is where it comes back to art versus science. If we think about it, if we go right back to our medical school teaching, right back more for some than others, 85% of our information is gained through our history, right? I think that's right. And you get another 10%, maybe even 15% from examination. So for anyone in the room not so into their maths, that doesn't leave much room for investigation. I've seen, I don't know how many kids I see for six-week checks per year. It's multiple dozen every year. I can't remember the last time I ordered a blood test on any kid with these sort of symptoms at this age. I might have checked a urine here or there, usually through a clean catch, not an invasive sample, but I don't order tests because I use history and exam. So then our last question we asked ourselves at the start was, when should we refer these children? Much like the AFL video review system, this is a flawed science. And that's because I think we don't use our GPs enough. So as emergency staff, our default a lot of the time is to refer through tertiary or hospital-based services. And really, I think for these babies that don't have acute problems, I'm not telling you to send a kid with sepsis or pyloric stenosis back to their GP. But for these kids, for the non-acute setting, they really should be going through their primary care providers. They're the ones who are doing the longitudinal care of these families, and they're the ones we're cutting out of the loop if we send a baby like this to a paediatrician. I'm not saying they can't come and see me, but why don't we use the GP's skills first, because they probably can do all of this, or at least 95% of it, and when they're uncomfortable, they'll refer on. So I've just got to put a little plug in here. Yeah, this is a very good friend of mine, and I think that's a very good quote. Cow's milk protein intolerance, given we're in a scientific conference, is evidence-based. So we have really good studies, lots of data, that points to the fact that the use of extensively hydrolyzed formulas, not partially, extensively hydrolyzed formulas, change the symptomatology in kids with a cow's milk protein intolerance versus artificial formulas or breastfeeding. You know, it presents with pathognomonically blood and mucus in the stool, but there's lots of other symptoms, constellations of vomiting, diarrhea, poor weight gain, rashes, you name it. I think it's important to think of. And if you think of it in an emergency department, you don't have to just send them off straight away. What I would suggest to you is pop them on an over-the-counter extensively hydrolyzed formula as a trial until they can get to the person they're going to see about that. So Allopro is a brand. I'm not sponsored by them, but if they're here, they can sponsor me. Because it's not that expensive. It's about $5 more expensive than a normal formula, and it's got the same ingredients as your Pepe Juniors and all the other ones. The only difference is it does contain lactose. Which brings me on to lactose intolerance. This is a scientific conference, right? I've said that a few times. Proteins are different to sugars. Take that home. Write it down. Put it on your forehead. I don't care. Just remember it. We get so many people, and this is parents as well as doctors, sending us kids with lactose intolerance. Primary lactose intolerance is rare stuff. It's said to be about 1 in 1 million. Maybe it's a little less than that, but it's 1 in 1 million, let's say. These kids can't tolerate breastfeeding. Breast milk is full of lactose. So they get really sick really quickly. They present within a few days of life. They're very abnormal children. They're highly jaundiced. This is not stuff you're going to miss. Yet 2/3 of the people that come in with symptoms that we've described get called lactose intolerance by their parents or their health professionals. So it's not lactose intolerance. All right? I've got that off my chest. I'm not putting this slide up to finish with just to please my wife, who's currently going through simplifying the life of a dual specialist family with 3 kids under 10. I'm putting it up to bring across my message of today's talk, and that is that, you know, this is art versus science, and I know I spent a fair bit of my conference last year speaking to one of the organisers about the fact that maybe we needed more science in this conference, and I'm going to tell you that actually this is an art, not a science. And you can read all your books and you can look at all your babies, but the reality is, unless you can listen to the families and translate that into what's normal and bring that across to the family, they're not going to have confidence in what you're saying. So the single message is learn normal and start from there. Go from there. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. If anyone has a question, if they could move towards the mic right now, that would be awesome. Or else I'm going to ask Jesse if there's any questions from the audience on Twitter.
Yeah, there's been a couple of good questions that really play on that art versus science dichotomy, I guess, with it. One being, do you have any good resources to refer to, given that it's been pointed out by the questioner, Josh, that many of the current guidelines, RCH included, still point towards PPIs and have concerning features in inverted commas that are largely normal.
Yeah. I guess the bottom line is that all of those symptoms can be abnormal once they start reaching a certain point. As I said to you, if you're vomiting and losing weight together, then that's a worry. The symptoms in their own right, where can you look for a good resource? I don't think I have one. And I do a lot of teaching of students on these issues, and the one thing I say to them is, this is acute, you've got to listen really carefully in, because this stuff is not in textbooks. I don't think there is an instruction manual. We didn't get one when we had our kids. And, you know, babies vary. And I guess to have the wherewithal to find out what is normal probably takes you to question others. And I don't mean talk to 10,000 mums about their experience. I mean just listen to the experience and expectations of your seniors in order to develop a feeling for what is allowed within the normal parameters. Once you've gone outside those parameters, you know, you're going to start to hit the abnormal. So the harder bit, I think, is not knowing where the normal is. It's convincing the parent that this is normal. And I think it's really, really important to make sure that you are explaining to the parent that this is the realms of normal. You're here. You're within that normal. And that you don't worry me as a specialist, and therefore you need to be reassured by that to some extent. That's a hard message to bring across. That takes a lot of practice.
Cool. Got one more quick one there, Jeff?
Yeah, one more quick one. Depends on how you answer it, I guess. someone very astutely, and I won't try and butcher your name, sorry, has asked, those five cases per year now that you are prescribing PPIs, yeah. What are driving that prescription?
So my name is Tikel. Oh, you meant Dana.
Yeah.
Anyway, my name's Tikel. Those five cases, I guess it's really a history thing, because again, that's 85%. So to me, you have to have really reproducible, significant reflux symptoms. I don't go doing tests. I don't believe in those for this sort of presentation. Severe irritability during feeds or really sustained irritability with every single vomit. This is a kid who's not thriving well. They have to have a constellation of symptoms that draw me towards reflux without another cause. So obviously I'd be thinking about things like cow's milk protein as well. But in the cases that I can't get on top of very, very discrete symptoms within that history, that's when I'd use them. It's not often.
Cool. Thank you, Dave. Wonderful talk.